Today on the Loopcast, I have Professor Dov Levin, author of Meddling in the Ballot Box, The Causes and Effects of Partisan Electoral Interventions. So why discuss electoral interventions? Obviously, our current sort of, at least in the United States, our current era and our current period is largely defined by an intervention that occurred in 2016. So there's lots of debate, both healthy and unhealthy, about what occurred in 2016, but it's still an intervention. So digging a little deeper, and the reason we wanted to discuss this on the show is that to understand electoral interventions, you have to go through three sets of literature: the intelligence literature, the historical literature, and then some political science. There isn't, at least as far as I know, there isn't a concrete framework, a good framework predicting when interventions, why they occur, why they succeed, why they fail. And what Professor Levin has done with this book is create that framework. And it is very thorough and very well argued. I have gone through the book once for this conversation, and I find myself having to go through it again because the framework is so richly detailed, and it does provide the ability for an analyst or for a political science student to use it, pick it up, and sort of use it to evaluate other electoral interventions. So it is a solid book. I do recommend picking it up. With that being said, please welcome my guest, Professor Levin. How's it going?
Okay, and thank you for inviting me, and thank you very much for your very kind introduction.
Oh, you're welcome. So I want to start off with a very basic question, is why study elections and electoral interventions? So because I think when we think about a democracy, we obviously have elections as the centerpiece of democracy. But at the same time, when you go to study it, when you go to break it apart and understand it, what sets an election apart from other institutions and processes within a democracy?
Well, elections are a special aspect of democracies, because they are the key domestic method in democracies to place a leader at the minimum cost and disruption possible. I mean, if you think about it, the ability of, you know, the electorate at one particular day or at a few weeks, in the case of the United States, to just, you know, go to a particular place, put in a piece of paper, or, you know, mail in some piece of paper saying, I want a different person or party to run my life. And then some people count it. And then, you know, a week or two later or a few weeks later, you know, the people in charge leave the office of the government and are replaced by the other people, is, you know, one of the most cheapest and cost-effective ways possible to replace a government, when you think about the other methods throughout history used for this purpose, you know, from civil wars to, you know, mass protests. And so that is one reason why they are special in a democracy. And likewise, you know, much of the system or leaders' legitimacy within the public in democracies depends on them, you know, being conducted in a way that is seen as acceptable to the local population. In other words, that the public inside that particular country will agree, you know, that person was actually supported by a majority, or at least, you know, a significant share of the population, and there were no, you know, unusual shenanigans by the standards of that particular time or place, so to speak. So a lot of the legitimacy of a leader and of a government inside a democracy comes from the perception of that election being more or less reflecting what the public wanted. So those are two reasons why, you know, elections are important, and why, of course, related to that, why electoral interventions are important, because foreign powers can use, you know, the same method that democracies have created in order to replace leaders in the most cheapest and cost-effective way possible, to also replace leaders or maintain leaders that they want or don't want in that country, in order to promote various interests that they have in regard to that particular place.
Interesting. So when it comes to comparing elections to other methods of political change, so elections versus lobbying or elections versus violent interference, why, in your view, would elections take primacy over, let's say, lobbying or, you know, donating money to a political party, or in the most sort of extreme sense, violent intervention?
Well, I think that there's two reasons. First, basically, it's a very common mode of interference. In other words, this type of intervention, which I call, you know, partisan electoral interventions, occurred in 117 cases by the United States or the Soviet Union and Russia between 1946 and 2000. And which is, just to give you an idea, in overall in general, occurred in one out of every nine national level executive elections. And this is much more common than, say, other methods that are much more, you know, which are much more well known, like covert coup d'etat, so to speak, or for that matter. So that is one important reason why to focus on them, that we're talking about, you know, a method of foreign interference that is much more common than, you know, other methods, which are, you know, you could call it, quote unquote, more sexy, as, you know, covert coup d'etats. As for lobbying, so to speak, I would argue that that basically the effects of these type of interventions is much larger than lobbying. So without, you know, getting into the issue of lobbying specifically, I would argue, you know, that the effect on, you know, changing a leader or not is much larger than, you know, say, the effects of the lobbying of various ways. So I would say these are two good reasons why to focus on it. First, that it's much more common, and second, that it has much more significant effects than other forms of interventions.
Awesome. So let's hop into the book. So within the book, you define a term which you've already used, and I'll repeat here, partisan electoral intervention. So define what that means and how you define it.
Yeah, when I talk about partisan electoral interventions, I am talking about a situation in which a foreign power intentionally intervenes in an election in another country in order to help or, you know, harm one of the candidates or parties in it using various costly methods. And, you know, there's a very large variety of methods that this includes, which have been done throughout, you know, the recorded history of such meddling, which are frequently tailored to the specific circumstances of the country or the needs of the assisted side. But I basically see that there's mainly six major methods for this purpose. You know, one is, you know, campaign funding, you know, that little, you know, the foreign power comes in and they gives, you know, funding to one of the sides. In a few cases, you know, literally like in one of those, you know, crime movies, you know, some meeting in a hotel, the two sides meet and one side takes out, you know, a suitcase or a black bag full of cash and transfers it to the other side. Another method that I include under this means the dirty tricks, by which I mean various messages are designed, you know, to harm the undesired side, you know, such, for example, leaking embarrassing information on them, or spreading quote unquote fake news on them, bribing a third party candidate to stay in the race or leave it. Or, you know, various messages that are designed, you know, to harm the side you don't want to succeed. Another method is, you know, various public or specific threats or promises, you know, like, for example, a short time before the election coming out and saying, if you vote for this guy, and you are going to suffer, you can forget about any foreign aid from us anymore. Or for that matter, a few weeks before the election coming and saying, well, if you vote for that person, you are going to gain a brand, you know, more foreign aid from us or any other concession. Another message could be, you know, campaigning assistance, which I include, you know, that in the run-up to the election, you provide, you know, training to the preferred side in various campaigning, their campaign message, how to mobilize, you know, voters to come, you know, to the polling stations on election day, or, you know, sending in campaign experts to, you know, help that particular campaign, you know, and developing, you know, a better ads, you know, better analysis of, you know, their election surveys and better, you know, a campaign strategy. Another method is, you know, giving or taking aid right in before the election, you know, before the election, if you want to aid the government, like, for example, you know, suddenly increasing, you know, the amount of foreign aid or other forms of material stuff you're regularly giving to them. Or, you know, right before the election, you know, just cutting it off, saying, you know, that government is awful and we're going to now cut off your foreign aid by half. And if you do that 2 weeks before the election, you hope that, quote unquote, the public in that country, you know, gets the signal. And another message is various, you know, non-material concessions, you know, like if that country, for example, wanted you to say, recognize part of its, a particular territorial claim, or, you know, withdraw from a particular, or, you know, give up some kind of not concede to something that you really wanted them to concede for a long time, which is non-material, you know, like say, for example, recognize a wrongdoing they did to you sometime in the past. That is another way you can, if you are the foreign power, intervene in this manner. So these would be, you know, the main type, this would be how I would define such intervention and the main message that are done for this purpose that we know of.
Interesting. So in the book, you lay out, you argue that interventions, political interventions, partisan electoral interventions, excuse me, only occur when certain conditions are met. And could you outline those conditions for us? And how do those conditions lead to success or failure of partisan electoral intervention?
Yeah, so I basically argue that such interventions occur only in when two concurrent conditions occur at the same time. And first is that the foreign power sees its interests as being greatly endangered by a significant party or candidate in that target. Basically, in some cases, the foreign power basically sees that candidate or party, either in reality or in perception, as having really inflexible preferences on important issues to the foreign power that diverge from it. So, you know, and those could be for various reasons, you know, like, for example, being that due to that candidate or party being greatly constrained by their own political base, you know, they know that if they say change their mind on it, a nice share of their own political base, quote unquote, will just, you know, not vote for them in the next election, you know, they're considered to be a horrendous, quote unquote, betrayal. Or, you know, because they are very ideologically committed to, you know, particular positions, so to speak. You know, when they worked in politics for 20, 30 years for a particular position, and they are not going to change it now that they have been working for it for so many years. And that, you know, makes it really costly for a foreign power to try to, you know, change their mind, you know, to try to change what they perceive or actually is a really committed actor on the other side to a different preference than yours would cost a large amount of resources of various kinds. So in that situation, other policy tools, like for example, you know, offering various carrots or sticks, you know, like increases in foreign aid or something like that, look like they're gonna like be very ineffective or relatively costly. So it is tempting for the great power instead of trying, you know, to negotiate with the other side and change their mind, just to place the other side, or at least prevent it from coming to power. So that is one condition, basically, that basically a foreign power sees one of the candidates or parties in their target as, you know, something that is threatening one or more of its key interests related to that particular country. Another, which is an even more important condition, is that another act significant domestic actor in that candidate or in that country is wants or is willing to be aided by that great power in this particular manner. What we know today under the term of quote unquote collusion. And basically the idea is that these type of interventions, unlike other forms of interventions, have to usually be quote unquote inside jobs. And this is basically due to the fact that an electoral intervention, when you look about how it actually works, is basically an attempt by the foreign power to strengthen or create a domestic election campaign for a particular side in that country. So the foreign power in that situation needs, you know, the same types of knowledge that the local candidates have, so to speak. You know, they need to know, you know, what type of messages work, so to speak. They need to know, you know, what type of stuff lead the publics to become more supportive of a particular side and which reject them. And without that knowledge, they are more likely to cause damage to the side they want to help rather than help it. So basically, they know that without, you know, domestic actors' willingness to cooperate and provided its knowledge, you know, on how to exactly help it win that particular election, its chances become so low that the local act that it really doesn't have any chances of success. So it needs to get the assistance of a local actor. But of course, for the local actor, that is not always something they are willing to accept. You know, and they know that, for example, in many situations, such an assistance can harm them. You know, if it's covert and it's exposed, it could, of course, naturally come back to haunt them. And likewise, if it's public, many of the voters may, you know, not be happy about a foreign power aiding them and not vote for them in another future election. So usually, many times the local actor has an incentive to just say no and reject the foreign power's offer of assistance on its side, which, you know, many times happened in many cases, so to speak. And so as a result, it only happens. So the agreement of the local actor to say yes is not automatic. It only happens when they are in what they perceive as serious political trouble. And without that agreement by the local actor to accept such assistance or quote unquote collude, we know such an intervention doesn't occur because the foreign power knows its chances of success are too low usually. So as a result, they are not willing to do it unless they get the local actor's willingness to cooperate with them. So that is why such stuff occurs. Naturally, I argue that from there, that also relates to the effects of this stuff on election results. Basically, one of the reasons why this stuff, I argue, increases the vote share of the preferred side and basically, you know, frequently helps it, so to speak, in what I find is an average of 3%, is basically because that there is a form of selection in this regard. Basically, foreign powers do not try to help, you know, quote unquote, lost causes, and actors that are very likely to win anyway are not willing to bear the various costs involved from, you know, getting the help of the foreign actor and will just say no. So usually these type of interventions occur in cases where such assistance can, quote unquote, move the needle for the preferred side, so to speak. And likewise, related from that, I find also that overt or public ones are usually more effective than covert ones. And one key reason for that is because that when it's expected by the local actor that, you know, if you do it in public, it could cause a backlash, then it basically tells the foreign actor, you have to do it in secret. My public is going to get really, really angry if they know that you aided me in any way. So you can only do it in secret. So basically, they only do such public interventions when they know that it will not lead to a backlash. So, and that is one key reason why it usually works in an effective manner, because in an overt one, when there is no backlash, basically the foreign power can bring more resources to bear, directly contact with the voters, and outbid, you know, the two local actors, so to speak.
Interesting. So I want to maybe switch footing to the database you created, or the data set, I should say. And that's an overview of U.S. Soviet Russian partisan electoral interventions from 1946 to 2000. I think this is the first of its, you know, first data set of its type. And I want to start off with, you know, why did you create this and what was the need to create this? And walk us through your thinking process. You know, how did you go through and code what is and isn't an intervention? And, you know, just walk us through that process, because I think this is fairly unique in terms of the overall research environment, in terms of this data set.
Yes, one of the reasons this is indeed the first data set of its kind, and one reason I created it was in order to be able to estimate the effects of such meddling in a systematic manner. How do you define such an intervention? The reason, the logic under defining it was basically, when I was coming to develop this data set, was to try to have it close as possible to how people actually define it in real life, quote unquote. In other words, I looked and saw, you know, I tried to get an idea from, you know, existing cases, what were the type of stuff that were usually included as, you know, as things that, you know, are denounced as such meddling, or, you know, people are accusing of others. And I tried to make sure that my definition included, most of those kind of acts, so to speak. So I made sure to include both the covert and the overt acts, so to speak, in this regard. And I also made sure when I was thinking about how to develop it, I wanted to make sure that I'm getting the whole range. In other words, you know, some research on it focused only, you know, on covert activities. A few things here and there talked about overt stuff. And I wanted to make sure that I'm getting the whole range of these kind of activities, so to speak, which, you know, what people perceive as being this type of meddling, so to speak. So basically, what I did is that I first, you know, looked for existing literature on this topic, you know, historical scholars, you know, critiques of U.S. foreign policy and things like that sometimes, you know, had some preliminary lists of, you know, this type of meddling. Then, you know, I took a look at them and carefully cross-checked them, so to speak. And they made, and, you know, sometimes, you know, these were really all the claims, you know, the United States intervened here, Russia intervened there. So then, you know, check them more in depth. And then, you know, after creating this initial list, I added other possible cases noted in reliable sources, you know, after carefully checking them, you know, things like, you know, like, for example, various congressional investigations of CIA activities, you know, like the Pike and Church Commission reports, you know, declassified CIA materials, you know, we're talking about the United States, and, you know, reliable histories of CIA and American covert operations, and, you know, memoirs by former, you know, CIA agents, you know, or U.S. government officials in general. You know, a lot of CIA agents, when they are in their job, are very secretive. But then when, you know, they retire, they start to become very talkative and write, you know, memoirs in which they say about how I, as secret agent X, prevented country W from becoming a communist. So that was very useful. Or histories, you know, of academic research and various American foreign activities. And likewise, when it came, you know, to Soviet things, you know, or Russian things, you know, memoirs of former KGB agents and defectors to the West, histories of the Cold War from the Soviet side. And likewise, this thing called the Metonkin Archive, which is, you know, this very unique historical source of basically this former KGB agent, a guy called Vasily Metonkin, who basically was a KGB archivist for 12 years. And during those 12 years, he basically created every day summaries of all of the documents he came across in the KGB archives. And then at the end of the Cold War, he basically ran off to the West with his summaries and published, with the help of Christopher Andrew, which is a British historian, these two fat volumes on all what he saw in the KGB archive. So that was another very useful source. And then, you know, I basically, to make sure that these sources, that I did not miss anything, I did, you know, keyword searches, you know, food documents, food these volumes of the U.S. foreign policy documents called the FUS, and also through newspaper archives, in which, in order, you know, to catch, you know, any public cases. And then any cases which were not, any cases that were not clear, I then basically went multiple times to the U.S. National Archives and looked, you know, through any available diplomatic documents. So, you know, in some cases, even, you know, these databases of CIA documents, in order to check whether it was or not a particular case of such an intervention. I basically continued in this up to 2000 in this early stage, because I wanted to make sure that they'd have time for the covert interventions of this kind, you know, to come out. In other words, basically, I discovered while I was working on it that it takes time for this type of, when this stuff is covert in nature, unlike, you know, the case of 2016, it usually takes a while until it comes out. So I wanted to make sure that I would get, that there would be time for the covert stuff to come out. So I stopped in 2000, because when I was doing this, when I was constructing this data set, this was the early 2010s. So I decided that something like around 10 years of a gap would be a good time to let, you know, the data, you know, any covert activities of this kind, you know, to come out, so to speak. And that is basically how I constructed this data set, you know, basically digging, you know, through these various sources, carefully cross-checking them, and, you know, making sure to confirm them with, you know, various reliable sources, you know, that are derived whenever possible, you know, from, you know, that particular country's own, you know, sources, so to speak. And that is how I covered it. I wanted to make sure that it was a definition that was both, you know, theoretically coherent and covered what most people, when they talk about such foreign meddling, mean in practice, so to speak.
So with constructing this data set, were there any surprises or anything that sort of popped out at you in terms of examples of interventions that, for example, did you find a case that was very much a stereotypical example of electoral intervention success? Did you find anything that was just very much a failure? You know, what did, you know, the gray space look like? What did that sort of in between, you know, very clear success and very clear failure look like within the data set?
Well, there were a few surprises. One of the surprises was how many of these cases there were, so to speak. I mean, when I began collecting this data set for my the earlier dissertation, and with my PhD dissertation, from which, you know, which was a very early version of my book in the early 2010s, I was not really sure that I'd have enough cases to do a statistical analysis. That is, I wasn't sure that I'd have enough cases. And then when I finished collecting all of the data and I found that there was in total 117 interventions of this kind, I was actually, you know, pretty surprised. So that was one wow, so to speak. You know, wow, there were that many. I myself did not expect that there would be so many, and that it would be that this was literally something that happened in one out of every nine national level executive elections during this period. The second thing that surprised me, so to speak, was the fact that a lot of these things occurred without the other side intervening. You know, during the Cold War era, the common stereotype about the Cold War era was, you know, that it was a struggle, that a lot of these struggles were these proxy wars, you know, or proxy war-like, you know, that when one side came in, the other side came in also, and that a lot of the fighting, at least that's the stereotype, or other types of interactions were, you know, boxing matches between the United States and the Soviet Union, or, you know, boxing matches between proxy of the United States and proxy of the Soviet Union. But what they actually found, so to speak, is that in most of these cases, even during the Cold War era, only one foreign power was intervening, so to speak. In other words, it usually, in most cases, a foreign power was intervening for one of the sides in the election, and the other power was staying out and was not getting involved in any way, so to speak. So that was, for me, another surprise, which eventually, when I developed my theoretical argument, I understood why, so to speak. Basically, in many cases, only a domestic actor would have a willingness to accept, you know, such foreign involvement, and other actors would not have such, you know, incentives to do that, so to speak. So that was, you know, a second surprise, you know, that there's actually very few, you know, situations, what I call double interventions, where the United States intervenes in one side of the election and the Soviet Union intervenes on another side of the same elections. You know, it's something like 7%, I believe, even in the Cold War era. So related to that, you know, the thing I discovered is that the cases that were the most famous of such meddling before, you know, 2016, you know, like Italy 1948 or Chile 1970, so to speak, where we did have a situation where, you know, the United States was intervening on one side and the Soviet Union was intervening on the other side, were actually the exceptional and unusual cases in this regard, so to speak. In other words, those cases which were the most famous before 2016 for such meddling were actually the exception, so to speak. So that was, you know, surprising, you know, that the cases that are always given when educated people before 2016 would have be mentioned this type of meddling were actually the unusual cases that did not represent how most such interference happened, so to speak. As for gray, you know, types of interference. Well, and actually, you know, when you try to code stuff and you follow a clear definition throughout, you know, a whole project like that, you get some cases which are not easy to code, so to speak. So I did whenever possible, I tried whenever I had those cases to try to collect more and more data. You know, I would go, as I said, when I had any case which was uncertain, I would go, you know, to the US National Archives, for example, if it was an American case, and tried, you know, to go through documents and hoping finally I will find, you know, a document that proved, you know, the United States was intervening or not intervening. Or, you know, I would consult some historians which were experts in this regard, or things like that. And basically, my guideline in this regard was that if I am uncertain in any way, I leave it out. In other words, my guideline was that if I had a case where I was not 100% certain that there was an intervention, you know, the evidence was not conclusive, that case, you know, stayed out. Only cases where I was completely certain that there was actually an interference were kept in, so to speak. Thankfully, in most cases, it was not difficult to, you know, do that. You know, the overt interventions are in most cases pretty clear cut because, you know, that's the goal of such overt interventions. You know, you are trying to send a message to the target's public and, you know, vote for him, not for him, not vote for this guy, not for that guy, so to speak. So, you know, they are usually pretty clear and obvious, and it comes out very clearly, you know, from, you know, the newspaper record and other sources that, you know, this was an overt intervention, so to speak. You know, it's literally the newspaper articles are saying, you know, foreign power X wants candidate W to win, so to speak. And as for the covert ones, and usually in most cases, you can find, you know, reliable evidence one way or the other. So there were some gray cases, and my goal was, you know, to minimize them as much as possible. Usually I succeeded, and in the few exceptions that they were not, those gray cases were left out for, you know, maybe one day I'll find it one way or the other, so to speak.
Interesting. So I want to switch footing again and discuss the 2016 Russian intervention in the U.S. elections. I want to, because your research is very provocative, and we have very much a very contemporary, four years ago. And if you can use the framework that you've created to analyze that. And more importantly, you know, I know it's kind of out of band. It's set in 2016. Your data set ends in 2000. But at the same time, I think you make this important point in the book, which is, you know, it is an out of sample case, but you still need to look at it, still need to analyze it. So if you can just walk us through, you know, how you pick apart the 2016 election.
Yeah. Basically, I basically analyzed it, and, you know, I did not expect it, of course, to happen, you know, like all of us, you know, completely didn't expect it to happen, but nevertheless, I thought that it would be a useful case to analyze because it first showed, you know, the relevance of the argument to the present. And because it was yet to happen when I was formulating my arguments and why it happens and its effects in the early 2010s, I couldn't, quote unquote, fit my argument to that particular case. So I thought it was a very useful case to analyze, you know, from the empirical point of view, given that this was a case that came out after I already formulated my arguments. So, and you know, it was outside of my the time of my data set, as well as my historical cases, so to speak. And I overall, you know, found that it fit pretty well with my predictions on when it occurs and its effects, you know, from what we know about about why Vladimir Putin intervened in this election, so to speak. It seems that Vladimir Putin was very, very and deeply afraid of Hillary Clinton, and he saw her, from what we know, as an existential threat, because he thought that, she would, if she was elected, would start a quote-unquote Cold War against Russia in response to Vladimir Putin's annexation of Crimea in 2014, so to speak. And likewise, as I expected, the circumstances where this intervention occurred inside the United States when it came to the domestic actor fit as well. That is, we now in retrospect sometimes think about 2016 as, you know, it was an election in which Trump was bound to win, but actually he was in a very bad political shape in the run-up to 2016. You know, no one expected him, you know, to win. He was behind and seems like fundraising 20-1 behind Hillary Clinton. A large share of the Republican Party in the run-up to the election refused to endorse him and quietly tied to harm him in various ways. You know, like, for example, the 2016 GOP convention, a lot of, you know, former presidents and many senators, many sitting senators and governors refused to, you know, participate. And, you know, sending a signal to a lot of the Republican rank and file, you voted for this guy, but we don't really like him. So, you know, So that was exactly the type of situation in which I would have expected, you know, a domestic actor to be in a bad enough shape to, you know, be willing to accept, you know, foreign involvement. And as we know from the Mueller report and other sources, there is some very strong circumstantial evidence that there was actually, you know, possible collusion in various routes, so to speak. It's not yet fully conclusive, but, you know, we have multiple pathways which show strong circumstantial evidence where that could have occurred, you know, through Manafort and through Michael Flynn, or maybe perhaps even directly through members of the Trump family, so to speak. So that fit pretty well with my prediction, so to speak, in this regard, you know, and likewise, it fit pretty well with what I expected about its effects. You know, I find in my book, when I was analyzing this case, which I analyze, you know, both, as I said, to see if my argument is still applicable post-2000, and of course, because everyone was very interested in that case, I find that this Russian intervention increased the voter of the preferred side by around 2%, so to speak. And I find this thing for analysis mainly of, you know, the effects of the leaks and hacks of the DNC and the Clinton campaign. In other words, unlike a focus of a lot of, you know, the commentary in this regard, you know, on the social media and, you know, the fake news, I focused instead on the effects of, you know, all of those leaks and hacks, you know, all of those leaks that came out for WikiLeaks, you know, about Hillary Clinton and the DNC. And I found, you know, that these things had a pretty significant effect. You know, like, for example, the document dump that WikiLeaks had for Russia right before the Democratic Party convention, which supposedly showed, you know, the Democratic primaries being rigged against Bernie Sanders, seems to have shifted and views negatively within significant shares of the American public against voting for Hillary Clinton. And likewise, I find it, you know, from pre-election polls, which I found that had, you know, relevant questions. And likewise, another leak in this regard for which I found, you know, a pre-election poll that I could analyze, you know, those, the leak of the speeches in early October 2016, in which, you know, Hillary Clinton was shown as supposedly saying to various executives of big companies stuff which was supposedly in contradiction of her stances otherwise, also had, you know, pretty negative effects on her prospects, so to speak. I found that, you know, though that leak of that speeches that came out a few hours after, you know, the Access Hollywood tape, you know, which famously had Donald Trump boasting about his supposed plans to sexually harass women and admissions of him supposedly doing that in the past, so to speak. And I found that, you know, this leak of these speeches took out something like 50.5% of the effect of that Access Hollywood tape. In other words, basically that Access Hollywood tape had a really bad negative hit on Donald Trump's support, as many people expected, but that counter leak from a foreign power in this case, unlike the Access Hollywood tape, of, you know, all of those Hillary Clinton speeches took out something like half of its negative effect, so to speak, and weakened that its overall effect, so to speak. And I likewise found that there was general public interest in this regard. In other words, when you check for keyword searches of WikiLeaks, which is, you know, the body for which most of these leaks came out that Russia hacked, and there was a big increase in such keyword searches all throughout the United States by a factor of, I believe, something like from a very big increase in the amount of searches for it once these leaks began to come out for WikiLeaks, both throughout the United States and especially in the key swing states. And I find that basically keyword searches were in amounts in the key swing states. In other words, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and also Florida. And then the number of such searches was larger than the vote shares by which Donald Trump won those states, so to speak. In other words, basically, there is clear evidence, as I would have predicted from my model, that such, interference is able to move the needle for the preferred side. The only thing I was surprised a bit was that covert meddling of this kind still moved the needle after its exposure. What I thought when this first came out in 2016, that the mere exposure of that act by Russia would make it completely ineffective. You know, when I heard, you know, that when I was in 2016 and I heard about the Russian intervention, I was sure, oh, we now know all about it. That means that no one will care about it. Clearly, the exposure was not enough to eliminate all its effects. And probably my assumption is more evidence that this was actually connected to Russia in order to counter the skepticism in some demographics that this was actually a Russian involvement. But overall, that is what I found in regard to the 2016 Russian intervention in the American case. It fit pretty well with my predictions on when it occurs and its effects, you know, as on election results. The only thing that was a bit unexpected for me was that the fact that the exposure which was showed, by the way, a major operational failure on the side of the Russian GRU and the Russian government, and did not weaken or eliminate its effects even further.
That's interesting. So we've come to the end of the show, and usually when we end the show, we always ask our speaker to give us something to think about. So when I say something to think about, either a provocative question or a question that you found provocative that's worth exploring, or implications of your work that are, you know, worth digging into in, you know, future with either students or yourself even. But, you know, give us something to think about, to chew on as a speaker, as an audience, you know, what have you.
Well, implications of my work. Well, unfortunately, my implications are, at least when it comes, you know, to the future in general, they are not very happy, because I expect such interventions to continue and to remain very common and to have and, you know, determine election results in many countries in practice. So one implication of my work is, given that the conditions why this stuff occurs are likely to persist into the future, you know, a lot of foreign powers are likely to see in the future local actors, you know, as threats to them, so to speak, with all of these major political shifts we've been seeing in the last decade or so inside even many Western countries. We're likely to see a lot of domestic political actors in deep political trouble and willing, you know, to accept, you know, such assistance in order to, quote unquote, save them. So in general, my implication in this regard would be, expect more of it and a lot more of it in the next few decades in a lot of places, so to speak. So 2016 is not the last case, and we're going to see more of it a lot in the future. That would be one, you could call it a public implication of my work. When it comes, you know, to... And of course, that implies, you know, as to public decision makers, that, you know, you need to think carefully how to deal with this type of intervention, so to speak, and how to prepare accordingly. As for scholarly implications, well, there is I believe in multiple ones. First, you know, that this is an important topic that needs, you know, more research. You know, I and other scholars have began studying other aspects of it, like the aspects of what its effects are, you know, post-election, so to speak. You know, if the preferred side won, and so, if the preferred side that you wanted to put in power, if you are the fine power, came to power, what's the name you call it? What are the effects on that country? So me and other scholars have found that there are such effects, and many of them are not, quote unquote, happy. You know, it has, you know, negative effects on domestic stability, you know, increases the probability of terrorism, increases the chances of democratic breakdown and things like that. But there's still a lot of research in this regard that is left to be done. So another implication is that this is an important topic, so to speak, that needs a lot more research so that we can understand it much better and, you know, understand what are its effects and its impacts in various ways, both on the country and maybe perhaps on the intervener itself in some cases. As for, you know, more wider implications to our scholarly literature, so to speak, well, it's certainly another piece of evidence showing, you know, when we talk about wider literatures, it certainly is another piece of evidence showing that leaders matter, so to speak, and that, you know, that a lot of that, you know, that other countries also deeply care about who is in power in another country. So, you know, assumptions that some IR series have, like realism, that, you know, a leader that, you know, the first image doesn't matter or can be effectively ignored as many times, you know, is probably inaccurate, what's the name you call it? It's further evidence for that. You know, of course, other scholars have talked about it when it comes, you know, to regime types and other literature, but this is, you know, additional proof in this regard. It also shows, you know, that a lot of stuff, like, for example, election results that were many times seen by some scholars as, you know, only affected by domestic concerns, actually are sometimes affected by international concerns, so to speak. So, you know, when you study elections, you need to take into account such interference. And, you know, if you are, say, running a pre-election survey in a country and to know what is the thing that affects the results, and you discover that, a week before the election, a foreign power is making a public threat, make sure to add that question to your pre-election survey, so to speak. And actually, another implication in this regard is that one key theory that we have in international relations, which is, you know, the democratic peace theory, clearly doesn't purview towards non-violent acts, so to speak, because we know that many of these interventions were done by the United States towards other full democracies, and we know other full democracies like the UK that sometimes in a few cases also meddled in this regard towards other full democracies. So the purview of the democratic peace clearly doesn't include a non-violent acts of these kinds. So these would be both my public implications of this work, which unfortunately are not very happy, as well as, you know, the scholarly implications of this work, which are, you know, some of them more positive. Like, for example, here's a field of research which is waiting just people to come and dig further and try to find what is happening with it.
Awesome. Well, we've reached the end of the show, and I would like to thank our speaker, Professor Dove Levin. He's the author of Meddling in the Ballot Box, The Causes and Effects of Partisan Electoral Interventions. This is a great book. Go ahead, if you're an analyst or a poli sci student, this is definitely worth your time looking through and reading. Again, thank you so much, Professor Levin.
And thank you very much for inviting me.